Morning, everybody.
Morning, Michael.
Good morning, Michael. I'm just recording it. I'm recording this in case there's questions.
Is that snow I see?
What do you see?
No. You know, it's trees. I'm walking in the street.
Oh, I see.
Michael, you want to start with Dylan, please?
Okay, Zevi. What are we doing?
Shehamalas. Me mama came to a seaside and I. And deny Shim of a colleague, he knows never because you both are called Takanunai.
Michael, I accidentally muted you. Unmute. Michael.
When did you mute me? Did you hear any of the tale or should I start all over?
Let's start over from the beginning.
Okay, Kuflamid. Shir Hamalos, Mimamakim Kurasika Adonai. Adonai Shimma Vakali, Tinos Naka Kashavos, the call Takamunai. Im Avonos Tishmayo Adonai Biyamo. Gim Kraslicha Laman Tibare. Gavisana Kisanashi Vidboro Hokolti. Nashi, Ladanaim, Shimon Laboke, Shimon Laboke. Yahaiso, Illinois, Kimonahese, Vade, Mopedus. Who yet is real, Mikolabonasal.
Yes, Michael, thank you. And today's learning is sponsored by Dina and Daniel Jarashow and family to commemorate the earth side of Daniel's mother, Irene Jarashow, Rachel Leah Bat Nachum. Was your site was on this past Shabbos. Okay, so I'm doing this because really I just felt I didn't want to go with a period of 8 days that we should miss 3 days of learning, so I'm giving it a shot. For those of us who go back, we actually learned Rabbi Silberstein's Sefer with Rabbi Yudin, I think it was actually every Monday morning, and most of us really liked it. And I saw an article in the paper that my wife kind of gets every week, the Atid, and they had some questions from his new Sefer. As you know, some of the stuff, at least to me, in my opinion, it was a little bit sounding like it was like fiction. And the first Shiloh that I have, you'll see what I mean after you hear the question. The way we're going to work this is I'm going to put the question that was asked to Rabbi Silberstein out there. And then if anybody has an answer to the Shiloh, we'll basically hear the different answers. And then after all, everybody basically gives an answer that wants to give one, I'll read the answer that Rabbi Silberstein gives. So here we go. Now, again, there's four of them. This is the first one. Person writes to Rabbi Silberstein, I'm a respected businessman. The questioner wrote, and I often travel by plane for my business. I was once in the airport on my way to close yet another deal when two men suddenly pounced on me without any prior warning. I soon discovered that they were police officers. They knocked me to the ground, handcuffed me, and then dragged me like a sack of potatoes to a waiting police car and hauled me off to jail. My clothes and my body were thoroughly searched, and all this was before I was even told the reason for my arrest. A full day passed before I found out about the serious charges I was facing. A bag of illegal drugs had been found in my jacket pocket. Evidently, a criminal who knew that he was about to be caught had slipped it into my pocket when he passed me in the airport. I suffered terribly in jail, where I was treated like a common criminal. Baruch Hashem, I was ultimately exonerated thanks to a seasoned lawyer who was clearly a shaliach of Hashem to prove my innocence. When I was released about a week later, the man account continues. I discovered that while their arrest had been a terrible ordeal, it was also a blessing in disguise for me. The plane on which I was supposed to be a passenger had crashed, and none of the passengers had survived, including the criminal who snuck his forbidden wares into my pocket. My life was saved because of that arrest. We are believing Jews, and we have faith that everything that Hashem does is for the best. But in this case, I had the privilege of observing that with my own eyes. My question is, am I required to ben shkomel for my release from jail? Or should I not recite the bracha, since it had become clear in retrospect that the arrest actually saved me from perishing in the plane crash? Okay, anybody want to chime in? Does he have to ben shkomel?
Okay, Mendy, let me chime in. Good morning.
Good morning.
First thing, if he gets released from prison, a person's chayav to ben shkomel. If he gets saved from a life-threatening situation, so what is the side that he doesn't have to ben shkomel? That's what I'd like to see. On what side does he not have to ben shkomel?
Okay. So you're saying he should ben shkomel?
Yeah, I'm saying it seems to be clear-cut that he should bench. I mean, that's what Rav Zilberstein is gunning for. Of course, right. It seems clear-cut, but there's got to be reasons why he shouldn't bench Gomel. So that's what I'd like to know.
I will see also the reasons that he gives. Anybody want to take the other side of the coin?
I agree with A, because just being saved from the plane, he should be able to bench Gomel, because he would have been on it and he was saved from that. And then again, like you said, being released from prison, so.
Well, the thing is, should he bench Gomel for basically being released from prison? So anyway, this is his answer. Okay.
Andy.
Right. It's a fascinating. What?
Hello? I have another question. Did everybody on that plane, did they deserve to die at the same time? Were they all being punished?
I don't know. We'll save that question for the rabbis, because I'm taping this, and we can send it to Rabbi Markowitz, basically, to answer any questions that are above my pay grade. Okay, so we'll have him review it. We'll have him review it. So anyway, his answer, he writes, Rabbi Zilberstein writes, it's a fascinating question. And the answer comes with an interesting line of reasoning. You were required to ben shkomel for being released from prison, the Rav informed his questioner. The fact that you were saved from the plane crash cannot possibly be seen as a reason not to give thanks to Hashem. That salvation should be a cause for additional gratitude. It should not be a reason to refrain from showing gratitude. So he says you should ben shkomel for the release of being taken out of prison, even though that act saved his life. But you should basically give an additional gratitude for now being saved from the plane crash. So the answer is, according to him, is yes. Like AB said, you should ben shkomel for the release of jail, from being released from jail. Okay, question two. This question was sent to the Rav by a woman who works in a store partially owned by... Mm-hmm. I'm going to mute everybody. Okay, the second question was sent from a woman who works in a store partially owned by a non-Jew and by a Jew. She writes, I work in an optician store owned by two partners, an irreligious Jew and a non-Jew. The woman's letter explains, when I am at work, I sometimes become outraged since I can see the non-Jewish partner is cheating his customers. He will often sell eyeglasses and contact lenses at prices much higher than he should be charging. And when the store is running a sale on certain types of eyeglasses, he will charge the ordinary price if he sees that a customer is unaware of the discount being offered. I would like to know if I'm allowed to continue working in the store. That's number one. Am I allowed to continue working in the store? And if I have an obligation to track down the customers who were cheated and inform them that their money was taken from them unjustly. So there's two questions. Can she continue to work in the store? And does she have to contact the customers who were cheated? Any answers?
Well, let me just point out that if she informed those customers that were cheated, then she would have take care of her first problem. She would not continue to work in that store. That should be clear.
Anybody else have something? Okay, so the answer that he gives, if those wrote in response.
I have a question. Is her allegiance to the boss, or is her allegiance to the customer and justice?
Well, she has two bosses, don't forget. She has the Jewish boss who's not doing anything wrong.
Right.
It's just one partner that's basically doing, he's doing something that's not right.
So well, I have a question. What happens if the Jewish partner is the one who's cheating?
Okay.
Is it the same answer?
These are the very good questions. And again, Michael, when we're finished, we'll send this over to Rabbi Markowitz for him to review, and he will give his comments, hopefully. Anyway, Rabbi Silverstein wrote in response, you do not have an obligation to quit your job since you, as an employee, haven't done anything wrong. Nevertheless, it's still advisable for you to leave the job so that you are not influenced by his deceit. This was a chiddush to me. The Rav felt that a person should avoid working for an unscrupulous employer in order to make sure that he does not learn to become dishonest himself. Okay. That's number two. Number three.
I think she should tell her the Jewish partner.
Okay. I hear you. And question number three.
So, Michael, before you get to number three.
Yes.
So basically what Rav Silverstein has said is that she should really not quit on the spot and lose a job. She should probably quietly look for another job and then leave. I think that's the implication.
He also brings out further, I didn't go through the whole story here, but he also brings that she can really be doing good if she continues staying there, because she might be able to correct, she would be seeing, she sees customers also. So all the people that come into the store that see her will not be cheated. But versus that, having to watch this guy do this after a while, a bad influence, it might rub off on her. So he felt that you shouldn't work in an environment where people are cheating, because within time, it's possible that you might, see bad examples and you might fall into the same way of doing business. So he felt, even though she was there to do some good by seeing customers, he felt overall the best thing for her would be to leave the job.
To leave immediately or to find another job?
He doesn't say to leave immediately, but I think overall I don't think you have to pick yourself up and leave like today, but because he did balance that out versus that she did good at the job and that was a plus. So I would think he would say within time, she should start to find another job. I don't think she has to go on day one.
Fascinating discussion, Scott.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, number three. Number three is an incident featured involves a dispute between a dry cleaner and a customer. Okay, the story began when the customer's suit was lost. I guess everybody has had something like this, while in the dry cleaner's possession. The two parties negotiated a compromise whereby the owner of the store would pay 2/3 of the value of a new suit, okay, and was approximately the value of the missing garment. The customer purchased a new suit before receiving the money from the dry cleaner, and guess what happened after that? What happened? And
the dry cleaner.
He found the suit.
That's right.
There you go.
That's the script. He found the suit. So having already made his purchase, the customer claimed that he was still entitled to the money that had been promised to him. Now that the lawsuit was found, I already have one suit for weekdays and another for Shabbos, and I don't need a third suit. I bought the new suit based on the dry cleaner's commitment to pay the 200 shekel. That means that I have suffered a monetary loss by purchasing an unneeded suit. The dry cleaner, on the other hand, argued that his commitment to pay his customer was valid only when the original suit was missing. Now that the suit had been found, I do not owe him anything, he asserted, since there was no actual damage. Okay, so what do you think? Does he have to pay him or not?
Okay, can I weigh in on this one?
Sure.
I'm thinking, Mitzad Hadin, he does not have to pay him, because when a dry cleaner makes this commitment and reaches on a compromise, what to do, it's always contingent upon if the suit is not found. If the suit is found at the last minute, then I would never have entered this compromise. I would have returned your suit to you. But lifnim mishuras hadin, I guess he should either keep his commitment or pay half of it. I don't know how Rav Zilberstein would rule.
How much time passed till he found the suit?
That's irrelevant.
It was a very short period of time.
It's absolutely not irrelevant. If it's a month later or 6 months later, it's absolutely not irrelevant.
That's not irrelevant.
It's until the guy buys another suit.
Well,
that's the timeline.
Right. Well, I think the cleaners took him. Okay.
Okay, so the answer that Rav Zilberstein gives is the Beis Din rule that the dry cleaner was not responsible to make good on his promise of payment to his customer for several reasons. He gives a bunch of reasons. First, the act of purchasing a new suit isn't considered a loss. It is merely an exchange of money for goods. And the dry cleaner had no obligation to reimburse him for spending money. Second, the customer should have consulted with the dry cleaner before making the purchase. And third, even if the dry cleaner actually owed him anything, he could simply pass off the original suit itself as the payment. So that's what he says. He says the dry cleaner was not responsible for those three reasons.
So I have a problem with that. So the rabbi, and you used the word in the sentence, Mendy, promise. So the promise doesn't mean anything. It's a promise and it doesn't mean anything. That's my kasha.
No, Jay, it's a contingent promise. It's clearly a promise on a contingency of I don't find it.
But so go back to your question, the timeline. I walk out of the store and the guy says, I can't find your suit. So if I tell the guy at that point, okay, I'm going to replace one. So at that point, it's a valid promise. There's no contingency. Right. I walked out of the store. He didn't have a suit. I need a new suit for Shabbos. I went and bought one. I got one for Shabbos. No response. You made a promise to me.
Point is that promise should be understood by the patron that it's only a promise if the suit is not found then you got to understand it clearly that it's not a promise.
If it's 6 months later, the promise is
right. You got to understand you're dealing with honest people here, that it's only a promise if he never finds it.
He knew to sue for Shabbos. You find it 6 months later. Sorry, guy. You owe me something.
Oh, no. Once that wasn't the question. He finds it and he comes with the bill. He says, here's the bill. I paid $200, $300. Give me $200, like you said. He said, no, I found your suit. That's not the same question. The question, instead of, right away, the guy says, here's the bill for my new suit. The guy says, oh, I have your suit. That's the question. It's not 6 months later. You can't get your money back six months later on this.
Abby, suppose you needed the suit for a wedding that was coming up. So he bought the suit, but it was out. I mean, then he's out the money.
I guess Rob Zilberstein points out, and Mindy said he should have asked him right away, I'm purchasing the suit. Is our deal on? If he didn't call him and notify him at that point, and the guy said, I don't have your suit, go purchase it, then it's binding. But if he didn't tell him, I'm buying the suit, I'm giving the money right now, and the guy tells him, don't do it, I found the suit, that's when it's binding. I think that's what you got to understand from the seven reasons that he quoted. One of them, he didn't notify him at the time.
But they already negotiated what the deal was.
That's irrelevant because it's all a negotiation. It's an understood contingency that at the moment that you buy it, if I don't have your old suit, I have to pay you. That's what the promise is. He didn't fulfill the condition of the promise that I have to notify the dry cleaner at that moment. He just said, oh, he promised me so I can buy it. I can go to Macy's tomorrow or the next day. I don't have to tell him I'm going to buy it for Shabbos. No, at the moment, that's what he didn't do. The patron didn't fulfill it.
If he walked out of the store and says, I'm buying a suit for that wedding.
Right.
Then he's putter, right? Then he's owed the 2/3, right?
No, until he actually was about to pass the money over. That's the minute that the promise would be binding. That's what I understand from Mendy's answer.
Excuse me, the day before cell phones, he walks out of the store and he goes to the soup. He goes to the department store and buys a suit. Right?
I hear that. I hear that, but that's not the answer Mendy explained. It's not the way Reb Zilberstein explained it with the seven reasons.
Yeah, but there are other things to consider. Gemara says that if somebody kills another person's ox, then he has to pay the value of the ox, and he gets to keep the ox. Mm-hmm. So the cleaner should keep the suit.
Correct.
All right, you're going up against Rob Zilberstein on this one.
Okay, like I said, we're taping this. We'll give it to Ryan Markowitz for his comments. Okay, the last question and the answer here is a little bit of a twist at the end. We'll see at the end who agrees with the last sentence where Rav Zilberstein says. Well, okay, so this is the last case. A man booked a catering call for a wedding and stipulated that the food served at the simcha should be prepared on the same day. On the night before the simcha, the Bar Simcha entered the kitchen in the catering hall and took pictures of the portions of food that had already been prepared. He was able to demonstrate conclusively in the Beis Din that some of the portions served at the wedding had been prepared on the previous day in violation of his agreement. He informed the Beis Din that the caterer had assured him before the wedding, if you find that I have served one portion from the previous night's simcha, you don't have to pay me a cent. Okay? So the Baal Simcha asked the Beis Din that he should be totally exempt based on the statement from the caterer from paying anything. Okay, so does he have to pay anything, nothing, a portion? What do you think? Anybody want to chime in?
Yes, I think he should pay. He should pay half. They got the food. Everybody ate the food, and then he complained.
One second. The deal that was made was that the food had to be made the day of the party.
Yes, that was the deal. He wanted everything fresh, and there were some portions that were made. X portions were made the night before. And the agreement was that even if one portion was made the night before, that's what he had in the contract, he didn't have to pay anything.
That was in the contract.
Yes, that was the agreement. I don't know if it was a written contract or verbal contract. I don't know if that makes a difference. Okay. But the agreement was, if you have one portion that was made the night before, he doesn't have to pay him anything.
I don't think any caterer would ever make that
deal. Okay, let's assume this is an Eretz Yisrael, you know, that's different there. Okay. They do things differently.
I think this touches on the questions of what's permissible to prepare on Shabbos versus what's necessary to prepare before Shabbos. My gut feeling is if he can demonstrate that any of the food that was prepared the night before tastes any less fresh the next day, he wouldn't be responsible for that food. But if there's stuff that cannot be distinguished to taste the next day, that it's as if it was prepared that day, then there was no violation of the principle because the food is as fresh as it possibly could be. That's what I would say the price should be.
All right. Anybody else?
Yes, I have something to say. If it was black and white in writing on a paper, then I think, you know, whatever is on paper, it holds. So he shouldn't pay. But if it's not, I think it's just the way people talk sometimes. If I did this, you don't have to pay me. I don't think you can really hold from that. So that's the way I would go.
Okay, so let's see what Rob Zilberstein says. Okay.
What was it? Was it Chinese food?
They serve bananas in the fruit cocktail.
Okay.
It had bananas in the fruit cocktail. Anyway, you guys kind of hit everything. You have all the answers here, but he says the Baal Simcha is required to pay for all the fresh portions, since the caterer's promise was an exaggeration, it was not binding. There is no need to pay him for the portions that had been made on the previous day, since it wasn't his intent to order them. However, this is the kicker, see if you agree with this, the caterer may have the right to demand payment from the guests who ate those portions. Again, the caterer can go to the guests and say, okay, here's your bill. You have to pay for today's meal.
That's a memorable wedding, let me tell you.
Are you saying that the guest?
Is
that what he said? The guest?
Zilberstein says.
That's Israel.
That the guest should pay because the Baal Simcha had an agreement with him for sure on this stuff. He basically doesn't have to pay any meal that was prepared the night, but the people that came to eat had hanah.
But they didn't even know there's a problem. They didn't even know there's a situation. Ridiculous.
So that means if they didn't know the situation, that there was no difference in taste between the one that was prepared the day.
No, what do you mean? It's definitely a difference, but
why? It depends what the food is.
What could be 10 and one could be 8 in terms of the how good it was. But, you know, he wanted 10. And it was purely acceptable at 8 as well. They enjoyed the meal. They had enough from the meal. And Baal Simcha doesn't have to pay because that was the agreement.
And the kids aren't getting a gift.
Mandy, no. Suppose... And this is the way that it's ruling, and people understand this. What is to keep the Baal Simcha from making an agreement with the caterer that this is what you're going to do, and then you go ahead and build the guest?
In other words, after this verdict, the Baal Simcha will actually step in and pay whatever left. He'll pay for the old portions. I mean, he's not going to let every single individual pay.
I don't think so.
I agree.
I don't even know which guest ate the old ones.
Okay, gentlemen.
He's not really going to demand from everybody payment.
You'd be surprised. I once got a bill.
Good. So I went to a Kiddush once, and I had to bring home for somebody who couldn't participate at the Kiddush. So I went to wrap up some food. I thought that was right. You had a Kiddush, you bring home food. And whoever was the mashgiach or the person in charge said, you can't take that food. The food belongs to the caterer. I was that happened. Okay. I don't know. That was in the United States.
Well, anyway, I think we're back to Rabbi Zilberstein again. I think everybody liked it years ago. It seems that this was, I think, a pretty successful Piskei Shuvos from him. If I come across any other ones, I'll maybe possibly do this again. Thank you so much.
Very good, man.
He has a new book, What If 5, just came out. What If Number 5?
Yeah, I got this from his new book. Again, the Atid published about, there were about another four more. I tried to get to the better questions. There was some, there was a question there about somebody who had only 3 months to live, but it was too close to home to talk about it. Didn't know what he had to do. But if you get the Atid from last week, and sometimes they have some very good articles in there. Okay, gentlemen.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Have a good day, Harav Mendy.
Thank you, Rabbi Mendy. Excellent.
Good. Okay, hope you enjoyed it. And have a
thank
good day.
You.
Very good. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mendy. Very good.
You're very welcome.
Excellent, Mendy. Outstanding.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonny. Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you,
Mendy.
Daddy.